You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
I wish to make a complaint.
Oh, sorry, we're closing for lunch.
Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot, what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Oh, yes, sir, the Norwegian Blue. What's wrong with it?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it, my lad. It's dead. That's what's wrong with it.
No, it's resting. Look.
Look, my lad, I know a dead parrot when I see one, and I'm looking at one right now.
No, that's not dead. It's resting.
Resting?
Yeah, resting. Remarkable bird, the Norwegian Blue, innit? Beautiful plumage.
The plumage don't enter into it. It's stone dead.
No, it's resting.
All right, then. If it's resting, I'll wake it up. Hello, Polly! I've got a nice fresh cuttlefish for you if you wake up Mr. Polly Parrot.
There, he moved.
No, he didn't. That was you pushing the cage.
I didn't.
Yes, you did. Hello, Polly! Wakey, wakey! Rise and shine! This is your 9 o'clock alarm call!
That was John Cleese in a classic Monty Python sketch that he co-wrote with fellow Python Graham Chapman, and a perfect example of his madcap creativity at work. Cleese is well acquainted with the creative process, both as an actor and as the Academy Award-nominated writer behind the Python's most famous sketches and movies, as well as the hit British sitcom Fawlty Towers and movies like A Fish Called Wanda and Fierce Creatures. Now he's sharing a few tricks of the trade in his new book, Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. And today, I'm thrilled to welcome this comedy legend on the podcast to talk about how he and the Pythons came up with that classic dead parrot sketch, the curmudgeonly hotel manager who inspired his character on Fawlty Towers, and the moment when he first realized he was funny. He opens up about his writing process, why he often finds inspiration in the most unlikely places, and how you can foster creativity in whatever you do. He explains why overconfidence is the enemy of creativity, where he gets his particular disdain for pompous politicians and feckless authority figures, and why he says that people in charge are always uncomfortable around comedians. Plus, he shares his thoughts on the state of comedy and the British royal family, why he turned down a lordship, and why he thinks Prince Charles will make a pretty good king, but Prince William, not so much. Coming up with John Cleese in just a moment. Today, I'm happy to welcome to the podcast a true comedy legend, John Cleese. He co-founded Monty Python, writing and performing in the TV series and in the films that include Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Monty Python's Life of Brian. He co-wrote and starred in the now classic sitcom Fawlty Towers, and later he wrote and co-starred in A Fish Called Wanda and Fierce Creatures. He's appeared in many other films from James Bond to Harry Potter and has guest starred in numerous television shows. He's also the author of So Anyway, a memoir, and now he's followed it up with a fun and informative little tome titled Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. John Cleese, welcome to the show.
Thank you for asking me on, Ben.
Well, I'm delighted to have you on. I've admired your work, honestly, for decades. I think I first discovered the Monty Python films and sketches when I was in high school.
Well, what age were you then? High school,
I'd say probably around 15 or so. But I was first introduced to you in the second or third movie that I ever saw when my mother took me and my little friends to see The Great Muppet Caper on my 5th birthday. And today, I still think that's my favorite Muppet movie.
Lovely. That was a very happy little film. I adored. I knew the Muppet people quite well because they came to London a few years before that, because a guy called Lou Gray was the only person who'd give them a show at a time when adults could watch it. Everyone in America said it was a kids' program. And they got a slot like 6 o'clock, which meant the people who just got back from work could sit down and watch it. So I got to know Jim and particularly Frank Oz very well. Lovely bunch of people.
That's so interesting. I didn't realize that it was on during prime time in the UK before it was on in prime time in the US.
Yeah, that's right. And they were over in London for some time. And I remember that the most extraordinary thing was that Jim Henson was in a road in Hampstead that was called Frognall. I'm not kidding. Frognall.
I love it. How perfectly fitting. Next thing you'll tell me that he lived in Toad Hall.
Right.
And I love your scene in The Great Muppet Caper because it's you and your wife having a very civilized dinner in your flat in probably Mayfair or somewhere. And it's sort of a marriage where everything has been said over the years and there's really nothing left to talk about. So you're just making idle small talk. And you say in this perfectly matter-of-fact way, there's a pig climbing up the side of the building. And then you just carry on about the weather or something. It is so quintessentially British. Just, you know, keep calm and carry on.
That's right. That was the way we used to be. We used to be very passionless. The French called it sans fire, cold-bloodedness.
Right. Well, I wonder what you think when you hear us Americans refer to sort of this catch-all term, quote, British humor. Because it seems to me that British humor, it ranges from Oscar Wilde and Noel Coward to political satire and black comedy, from the silliness of the Pythons or Benny Hill to comedians like Eddie Izzard and Russell Brand. It seems to me that British comedy is far more diverse than we Yanks ever give you credit for. So I'm curious how you define British humor.
No, I don't. I don't, but for the exact reason, most people don't see what you just said, which is absolutely right. There's all types of humor. And I practice and enjoy most of those kind of humor too. But I think the main difference between English and American humor, not that you can even say, what you just said about English humor is also true of American humor, because if you go to large areas of the Midwest and the South, they really don't get irony. They are much more literal minded. True. Whereas if you're on either coast or around the Great Lakes, Americans get it exactly in the same way the Europeans do. But go on.
That's a really interesting observation. And I was actually interested to read in your new book that you didn't start out on a particularly creative or humorous track in life. You actually studied science in school and then law at Cambridge. When did you first discover that you were a funny guy?
Well, I had to join the Footlights Club at Cambridge. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was like the Hasty Pudding Club at Harvard. It was a little club. We had our own club room and a tiny little stage one end and a little bar the other. So it was a lovely place to go in the evening. And the guys there were the nicest bunch at Cambridge because they all had a good sense of humor and they didn't take themselves too seriously. They weren't playing kind of one-up, as we call it, where like a lot of students, particularly the serious actors, who all always thought they were the bee's knees. I took themselves much more seriously than we did. But I discovered that I could make people laugh, and I discovered that I could take a sheet of blank paper and write something on it, and people would laugh at it if I performed it right. And then I began to think, well, this must be creativity. And then I began to notice things that completely changed my way of thinking about almost everything. I mean, one time I lost a script and I knew Chapman, I'd written it with him, would be angry because I was always losing things. So I, in the end, I couldn't find it. So I wrote it out from memory. And then I found the original. So I compared the two and found the second one was better. I wasn't trying to make it better, But my mind must have been working on it during the gap. Do you see what I mean? And then I would discover if I couldn't figure something out late at night, I'd sit there beating my brains. And in the morning, I'd sit down with a cup of coffee and just glance over there. And the solution would pop in my mind almost straight away. So the only explanation for this, it happens so often, was that my mind had been working on it while I'd been asleep. And, you know, this brought up this question of the unconscious and everything else. So my whole attitude towards everything to do with human beings started to change from that moment.
That's fascinating. It's as if your mind was editing while you were sleeping. And yes, I think we're only now starting to appreciate all the things that go on when we're sleeping. We used to think that that's just kind of dead time, but it's not. The mind is doing a million different activities while we're sleeping.
A million different things. The only problem is that when you're asleep and when you're unconscious is at work, it communicates like with the language of dreams. It doesn't give you neat printed out thoughts. Mm. It's feelings, it's images, it's hunches. It's very indefinable stuff, a bit rather touchy-feely stuff, really. And if you've had the standard education, either in England or America, you're really not taught to value that. You're just taught to value clear, logical, verbal thinking. And that if it's not clear and logical and verbal, it really isn't worth spending any time on. And it's completely wrong. It's completely wrong. And what we have to start taking into account now is that the more creative sides of us, the slower thinking as opposed to the fast, logical sort of lawyer thinking, the slower thinking is much better at solving certain kind of problems. You see, if you've got a maths problem, two trains leave Detroit and Chicago, you know, all that sort of thing, and so many miles an hour, where do they crash? That you don't need a meditative kind of thinking. Thinking for that. It's a maths problem. You know all the factors, right. You've got all the measurements. But the more you're dealing with a problem and you don't have all the factors, or at least you can't measure them, so how do I deal with this difficult situation at the office with these three guys? You can't solve that on logic. You have to feel it out. You have to allow your unconscious, which has got a phenomenal amount of information, to just nudge you in the right direction, but it won't give you a straight verbal order.
Now, John, I feel like I'm going to get in trouble with my wife if I don't push back a little bit on something you just said a moment ago when you used the term lawyer thinking. I think rather derisively, because she is a lawyer. Oh. And I discussed your book with her, and in particular, the part about the harebrained and tortoise mind. And she says that a lawyer uses both. You need the fast thinking to be able to get into law school and pass the bar.
Yes.
But then in practice, she does
quite
a lot of slow thinking in trying to analyze all the various angles of a case, all the variables, and especially the unknown variables, the subjective aspects of it, and how that might play to a judge or jury. And then she also says that trial then requires a lot of fast thinking. So she says a lawyer uses both, or at least a good lawyer does.
Sorry, your wife, you see, is lucky enough to be a woman. And when I talk about creativity, you know, and I lecture to quite large audiences every now and again towards the end of the lecture, I notice a few people fidgeting, and they're always the women. Because
really?
The women use that part of their mind much more than men do. You see what I mean? So a lot of what I'm saying is almost obvious to women, whereas the engineers, the white middle class engineers, often think that what I'm talking about in creativity is pretty much rubbish, because they hate the way of thinking where you don't just use the logical mind.
I guess, you know, we tend to think of creativity and we think of writers, artists, musicians. We have this very narrow definition of creativity, but really most people who are good at what they do are so, in part at least, because they take a creative approach to the job or a creative approach to problems.
It simply means coming up with better ideas. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether it's how to design the office or flower arranging or something that's normally regarded as artistic. It just doesn't matter. If you know how to come up with better ways of doing whatever it is that you're interested in doing, that's incredibly valuable. And the astonishing thing, man, the astonishing thing is that we don't get taught this at school.
No, see, that's true.
True. And when you see, when you're a kid, you play, right? And there was a marvelous guy, I can't remember his name, but he was from Hallmark Cards. And he used to go into schools to talk to classes about creativity. And he said that the six-year-olds, he'd say, who's creative? Everyone's hand would go up. And the 10-year-olds, well, about half the hands would go up. By the time he got to 16, he'd say, who's creative? And people would look around the room to see who this misfit was. Because what we're taught at school is what is right and what is wrong. This answer's right, this answer's wrong. That's not terribly interesting, you know, because there's a lot of gradations in between, and that isn't explained to us. So we're much more frightened of making a mistake than we should be, which means we tend not to risk anything, which means that we stick to our stereotypical thinking.
I wonder if you think that's starting to change, though, because I hear a lot more about nurturing curiosity and critical thinking in schools and teaching kids how to think as opposed to what to think or rote memorization. Do you think we might be getting a little bit better at fostering creativity?
Well, I like to think so, because 20, 30 years ago, when I started thinking about this or putting it down into script form, because I've been thinking about it all my life, I began to see that it began to look better. But I'm not so sure that it is. I think most of our faults now, and you've only got to see the arguments that go on politically, is to see that people are into binary thinking. You know, it's either black or white, it's right or wrong. And that's not where human beings are. Human beings are arranged on a spectrum for everything, and some people are up one end and some are up the other, and the vast majority are in the middle. And that way of thinking is much more constructive, because once you've admitted that the people you're arguing with have some good points, then you have a chance to move on to something better.
Yeah, I like that you have a section in here on the dangers of overconfidence. And I want to quote from your book. You say something here. This is a quote. When people become absurdly certain that they know what they're doing, that's when their creativity plummets. They think they have nothing more to learn. Most people want to be right. The very best people, however, want to know if they're right. I felt that that was so spot on, not just in terms of creativity, but society in general, especially where we are right now. Far too many people, from the president on down, just are unwilling to admit what they don't know. And I find that to be one of the most noble qualities that a person can have, a willingness to admit their own ignorance and to admit mistakes. Because I always say this to friends. I say, I would rather be wrong than right, because if I'm right, I get the satisfaction of being right. But if I'm wrong, I actually get to learn something and grow.
Well, one of my heroes is Richard Feynman, the physicist. And I came across a quote by him. This will not be accurate, but he basically says, I'd rather live in a state of uncertainty and being curious about things than to live in a state of being absolutely sure about things that actually I can't possibly be sure about. And, you know, and people want to be right. I've actually got a speech called Why There Is No Hope, and I talk about stupidity a lot. And I get lots of laughs from the audience talking about ordinary stupidity, like the woman in 2016 who was asked about Trump's comments about women expecting celebrities to grab them by the you-know-what. You know, that was what
know.
Expected from
we
celebrities.
Remember.
And the woman said, he would never have said that if he'd known he was being recorded. Now, that is stupidity of a wonderfully high order. You don't get any more stupid than that. But then there's a whole other range of stupidity, which is highly intelligent people who are so sure that they're right that they will not look at evidence that would make them revise their opinion. And this is, I believe, is very true of science today, because so many scientists refuse to look at paranormal phenomena, which have been proved beyond any conceivable doubt. There's a book called Real Magic by Dean Radin. And if you go to chapter 5 or 6 in that and read the the laboratory work on certain of these psi qualities, you'll find there's no question that they exist. But the scientists get quite angry And they said, well, if we agreed this, our whole of the structure of science would collapse. It's bullshit. You just adjust it and put new things in. It doesn't mean the whole thing falls to pieces, but they criticize it or hate psi phenomena and talk about it, not because it's wrong, but because it would attack their basic principles, which is absolutely the opposite of proper scientific thinking.
Right. You make a good point, because scientists are supposed to start by admitting what they don't know and have a sort of openness to all the possibilities, at least until they can prove or disprove something.
It was a wonderful book by, I think of his name, Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, called The Structure of Scientific Revolution. I think it came out in 62, and it was basically said that scientists are very, very emotionally attached to their theories. And they're not these sort of dispassionate people sitting quietly in an ivory tower making dispassionate judgments. They're hugely emotionally involved in their theories, and they hate people who try to change the theory or show that it's not quite right. And this was immediately proved to be true by the outburst of vicious, angry criticisms of Mr. Kuhn by the aforesaid dispassionate scientists. They were absolutely furious that he was saying they were not dispassionate, and they got very angry about it. Hugely funny, you know. As I say, God makes the best jokes.
Isn't that true? Then Trump is probably proof of his existence, I suppose. But you're not someone who is anti-science. You reference quite a few scientists in your book, and in particular the fact that science can be a surprisingly creative field and how play comes into the process. For instance, Einstein and Feynman both played musical instruments to meditate on a problem. And I think that you'll find this interesting, John. I once read a survey of Nobel Prize-winning scientists, and almost all of them had some kind of artistic pursuit on the side, whether it was writing or painting, music, sculpting, whatever. And in fact, that's when some of the biggest breakthroughs happen, isn't it?
Well, they could play, you see. And Feynman used to go off from his physics and his quantum physics and play the drums for 4 hours. That's what I love about the man. And Einstein said that when he was thinking, he could not describe to anyone at that time in words what he was thinking. He said it was, he couldn't put it into words. It was feelings, and he even said muscular feelings were part of his thinking process, which is astonishing. And Edison used to think he got the best ideas between being awake and being asleep in that slightly drowsy state. So he used to sit in a comfortable chair with ball bearings in his hand. Did you know this?
You're not being cheeky. You mean a literal pair of ball bearings, right?
A handful of ball bearings, and he'd sit there with a large metal plate by the side of the chair, and if he actually dozed off, his hand would relax, the ball bearings would splatter onto the plate, the noise would wake him up, he'd pick up the ball bearings again and go back into this drowsy state. But you notice drowsy because, you see, there's such an emphasis of clarity that people don't like confusion. But when you go be creative and you're coming up with stuff for the first time, it's going to feel confusing because you've never been there before. Mm-hmm. You don't recognize something, it's not familiar, feels a bit scary and confusing, and that you have to go through that if you're ever going to be creative. Because if you just stick to what you know, you'll have clarity, but you'll never come up with anything new.
True. It sort of flies against the idea that we have of an artist toiling away at a piece of marble or a writer just chained to his desk, sleepless for nights and days. Yeah. We think of sleep or break or play or writer's block as impediments to work, but you have a more holistic view, which is that these things are really integral to the process.
Absolutely. You see, I have to say I've never had writer's block, and it may be because I don't normally write about anything that's very highly personal or that stirs up very deep and perhaps uncomfortable feelings. And if I did, then I might get writer's block. But when I started to work with Graham Chapman right back in the 60s, he and I would get a bit sort of snarky if we didn't come up with anything. And you could sit there for a whole day and the waste paper basket would be full of crumpled up paper because you didn't like anything you'd come up with. And we used to beat ourselves up, not each other, but we used to beat ourselves up and feel inadequate. And then you'd have a really good day. The next day, suddenly it would all start to flow. And once we realized that we could do 15 to 18 minutes of good sketch material every week, we stopped worrying on the days where it wasn't coming. And then somebody said to me, a psychiatrist said to me, that Gregory Bateson, who was married to Margaret Mead, had once said, you can't have a new idea until you've got rid of an old one. And I suddenly thought, maybe those periods when nothing is coming, you're kind of creating a space slowly in your mind for a new idea to move into it. And then I began to see it was all part of the same process. The good days, the bad days, didn't matter on the bad days. Don't beat yourself up. Doesn't get you anywhere. Go and play a board game. Just or do a jigsaw. I think if you want to just let your unconscious run, then doing a jigsaw is almost perfect because you can just sit there just doing the pieces and that occupies your conscious mind, you know, looking for shapes and colors. And then your unconscious mind can roam all over the place.
What do you personally do to play to get your mind off of your work and get in that zone?
Oh, I think everybody does it without realizing exactly why they're doing it, because writers know you never sit down and start writing. You sit down and then you realize your socks have got to be sorted. The books on your bookshelf are not in the right order, or nobody's cleaned the window. So you find lots of things to do. And what you're actually doing is just letting your mind get away from ordinary everyday thinking into a slower, quieter, more sort of how many socks have I got today kind of thinking. So people don't realize it. They think it's because they can't get down to thinking, and it isn't. It's preparing their mind to think in a more creative way.
What's the best idea you ever came up with while rearranging your sock drawer?
I don't know. I mean, the other day I was I'm sitting here in Mustique in the West Indies, and I swam a few laps, not many, because I'm very, very old and very near death. And I popped out of the water, and I suddenly thought, oh, that's wonderful. And it was an answer to how to manage a particular scene in the middle of a movie that I'm writing a treatment of. And so I hadn't been thinking about it for hours consciously. But Noel Coward once wrote one of his best plays in 2 days. And everybody said, how is it possible? And the answer is because he'd been thinking about it for a year. Mm-hmm. There's a great English playwright called Alan Ayckbourn who's written God knows how many great comedies, 60 or something. He's extraordinarily prolific, but he doesn't actually like writing. So he does it all at the end in a very short period of time, really? But he's been thinking about it all year.
It also reminds me of how many of the great British writers like Oscar Wilde and George Bernard Shaw were avid ramblers. And I don't mean verbally, but there is this particular British tradition of rambling or going on these hours-long meditative walks through the countryside. And while they were trekking about, they were doing their best writing all inside of their head. It wasn't a waste of time at all.
No, but what you do have to do is you've got to put in a bit of thinking too. If you try to make a scene work, you need to think, well, where are we at the start of the scene? What's the emotional state of this character? What's the emotional state of that character? How would it, and you do a certain amount of it logically thinking about this situation and how do we get to the next situation, because then we need that for the next scene and we know how that's going to be. And this business about sort of studying it and thinking about it, that's much more conscious. But then if you do that, you suddenly get a reward when you're rambling out in the woods.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. There are so many examples of how inspiration strikes at the most unlikely moments. And I wonder if you feel that you almost have to live it, this philosophy of life where you go through every day with a certain openness to inspiration, wherever you might find it, not just when you're at the typewriter.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think going back to something you were talking about earlier, I was talking about various forms of stupidity. But the greatest form of stupidity among intelligent people is they're so sure that they're right that they suffer from what psychologists call confirmatory bias. Mm-hmm. That is to say, it's a natural, this is all perfectly natural human behavior because we want to be right. Probably because when we were six years old, people said to us, no, that's not right. And we thought, oh, I have to be right. What happens is if you have a view and somebody gives you evidence proving that it's right, and then somebody else gives you evidence proving that it's wrong, two pieces of evidence, you're more likely to believe the evidence that says that you're right. Mm-hmm. You see, well, you're biased towards right. confirming what you already know. And that's why right-wing people read or watch Fox News, and left-wing people are more likely to watch, I don't know, read the New York Times. You know, right. people like to have their opinions confirmed. And I think the one thing that's quite good about me is I'm interested in anomalies. I'm interested when I suddenly hear that the Republicans in the last few months have been registering a lot of non-college educated white males who've never voted before. Nobody's ever told me about these people who never voted before. And, you know, the Republicans have been registering them in numbers at least twice what the Democrats have been doing. Now, that's interesting. I never knew that. That was a sort of an anomaly because it didn't fit into other accounts. And those things immediately interest me. That's why I find things like out-of-body experience is so interesting, because it confirms an idea that the mind doesn't produce consciousness, but it's like a TV set that gives you the program. It doesn't produce the program in the set. The ideas or the perception or the consciousness might be outside us, and our minds are a way of letting us register what it's saying. And that's why people can go for can in the middle of operations when they nearly die, if it's a near-death experiment, they seem to be able to go to other places or watch the operation from above. Mm-hmm. And actually be able to report afterwards what happened when they couldn't possibly really have guessed what happened, and they're able to report conversations that they couldn't have heard because their ordinary perceptual system had been turned off for safety reasons during the operation. Yeah. So this is fascinating. That's when I say, oh, I didn't know that. Most people will say, oh, that couldn't have happened. Well, what do you mean? That could mean we don't have a scientific theory for it yet. You see what I mean? People can't come up with a theory to explain something. They think it can't happen, and science doesn't work that way. Science works from data to theories, not from theories to data.
Right, and you have this thing called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where the more wrong you are, the more you cling to your assumptions, whereas the most intelligent people tend to be those who are most open to ideas that challenge their beliefs. But if I were to guess, I suppose that there's a good deal more laziness to it than most people are willing to admit, because it requires little to no effort to cling to your current beliefs, but it's a lot more work to take new evidence into account and be willing to reevaluate your assumptions and see if they still hold up under scrutiny, isn't it?
Much more effort, and it means you've got to admit you don't know. And people love to pretend that they know things. If you ask them, well, they don't really know about it. No, but they kind of think that their opinion is right because, well, why? Because it's their opinion.
True. I wonder, many of your characters are send-offs of kind of pompous British aristocracy, bureaucrats, these authority figures whose intelligence is not commensurate with their station in life. Where does that rebelliousness against authority and the upper crust come from in you?
Well, it comes from observing the world, realizing, first of all, that most of the people in charge have no real idea what they're doing. And that started for me as a professional realization that so few of the film and television executives actually knew what they were doing. But the alarming thing was they had no idea that they had no idea what they were doing. And because they had no idea that they didn't know what they were doing, they were filled with a kind of false confidence. You see, whereas if you, more like me, if we get together, if I was working with a group of actors, I wouldn't say I know how this scene needs to be played. I'd say, let's rehearse it a bit and see what we come up with and what we like. And one actor might come up with something, and I say, that's the opposite of what I was thinking, and it's better. I remember at the read-through of Fish Called Wanda, there was several people at the read-through other than the actors, including a first assistant director called Jonathan Benson. And after we got to about page 40, Jonathan suddenly said, wouldn't it be funnier if he said that? And I said, oh, yeah, that's much funnier. And I just crossed out the line in the script and wrote it down. And I looked at Jamie, who was looking at me kind of slack-jawed, and I said, what? And she said, that is so great. That would never have happened in America, because no first assistant would ever have had the courage to make a suggestion. And if you do that, then everybody gets involved creatively, and that's a huge motivational force.
I agree, but Jamie's right. In the typical writer's room in Hollywood on a TV show here, there's always some writer who clings like grim death to his original idea and gets his nose all bent out of a shape whenever someone comes up with a better joke. And in the book, you also talk about these collaborations and the importance of bringing in different viewpoints and skill sets to a project.
This is why diversity is so important. Mm-hmm. Because if you get a room, say 20 years ago, full of white middle-aged men, they will report afterwards, you know, what a nice experience it's been. They very much enjoyed it and they want to do it again. And they would come up with fuck all, because they all agreed with each other. You see, what you want is lots of different ideas. Mm-hmm. The only problem with diversity is if you have diversity of culture, then you can get a bit of culture friction, which doesn't help. So you've got to have someone in charge for a particular who will shut up the people who talk too much, will encourage the shy ones to say more. You know, Michael Palin, who was one of the finest writers of comic characters I've ever come across, went off and did those boring travel programs. Terry Gilliam became a major, spectacular film director. Terry Jones wrote children's stories and directed and wrote books about Chaucer. Eric Idle had huge musical talents and a wonderful ability to write lyrics. And Chapman was just wonderful at coming up with off-the-wall ideas, but very, very lazy. So what you want in a good team is people with different abilities and qualities, not with the same ones.
And I'll tell you, every time I watch a Python sketch, I inevitably wonder, where does someone come up with something like that? For example, the dead parrot sketch. Could you walk us through the evolution of that one? How did you guys come up with that?
Well, the dead parrot sketch was based on a sketch about a secondhand car.
Okay.
That surprise you?
It does.
Michael Palin had bought a car. He told us about this. And the guy who owned the garage was a particular type. And when Michael would go in and say, I'm having trouble with the gearbox, he would always say things like, well, you know, a good quality car like this, or this gearbox will always be a bit sticky for the first. You know, he says, you have any trouble with it, bring it in. And Michael said, well, I am having trouble with it. I have brought it in. And he would say, yeah, well, you have any trouble, bring it in. And you couldn't get anywhere with the man. And so we wrote the sketch and he was just slippery. And then Graham and I looked at it and I said, a secondhand car sale is so cliched. I said, can we do it about anything else? And then Chapman said, what about a pet shop? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, somebody's bought a pet and they brought it back because it's not working properly. And I said, well, you mean it's dead? And he says, yeah, that's funny. It's dead. And we said, well, what is it? Well, it can't be a cat because people love them too much. Same with dogs. Can't be a mouse because that's too tiny. It's sort of picking on something that's small and defenseless. And then, oh, parrot. Good idea. I said, parrot. Yeah, parrot, because nobody likes parrots, not even people who
get that's so true.
Eat parrots. They don't like parrots. Yeah, let's rewrite the car sketch about a parrot. So that's the sort of playfulness, you see. You don't get that if you're trying too hard to solve it. But the more playful you are with humor, you see, whenever there's humor around the spontaneity, or to put it another way, whenever there's spontaneity around this humor, and that kind of atmosphere is more likely to come up with something than people beating their brains and furrowing their brows. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think better when people play. And I think the great scientists, the great mathematicians play. And you know, so mathematicians will, for example, they prefer one particular proof to another because it's beautiful. Now, that's not a logical judgment.
That's true.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They say, we like this idea because it's beautiful. He said, and it pleases them aesthetically, not logically. Mm. They know it's also logically true, but they prefer it to the other logical truth.
I've heard that the idea for Fawlty Towers was also one of those things that came to you from a random life experience where you weren't necessarily looking for the next idea for a hit TV series. You just kind of stumbled onto a situation or a person that inspired that, and your mind was open to the inspiration, huh?
Well, Connie and I wanted to do something together. And finally, the BBC said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, let me go and talk about it with Connie. And she had stayed in the same hotel with me, the Glen Eagle Hotel, when there was this marvelously rude man, Donald Sinclair. And when we started to think about the things that had happened, like the first time I ever walked into the hotel and he was sitting at the desk and he saw me coming and turned his back on me and pretended he was busy so that he didn't have to waste his time on me. And I went and stood by the desk for some time, and eventually I said, and he just turned to me and he said, oh, what? First words you ever spoke. Well, when you've got something like that, you don't have to be that creative.
Right.
You know? I mean, he also had a wife who henpecked him, and he was quite small physically, and I was large. So that was, he was small physically, and his wife was large. So that was good, because I was much larger than Prue Scales, who played my wife. So that hid the fact that it was henpecked husband a little, which made it a little more interesting. And then we would just work out what could happen. And that was not like Python. That was quite logical. I mean, I said to a very good friend of mine who trained at the Savoy Hotel, I said, what was the main problem you had with when they were working at the hotel? What was the worst problem? And he said, getting rid of the stiffs.
And I said, literal stiffs or
figures? Yeah. People who would die in their sleep. Yeah. Sometimes I'm sad to say they were little old upper class ladies with lots of money who had outlived all their friends. And they check into the Savoy with a little bottle of pills and they would wake up dead. And the Savoy would have to get the bodies out without any of the guests. Well, once he told us that, it didn't require Connie and me to be terribly creative to write the dead body episode. Yeah. You know? We still had
that's where
ideas.
That comes from.
Yeah, that's where that came from. And that didn't happen with Python. We didn't ever go into a shop and ask for a mattress and find that the shop assistant had put a brown paper bag over his head and we had to sing Jerusalem until he took it off. Different type of creativity.
Well, I want to ask you, what do you think of the state of comedy today? Is there very much out there that you find personally funny?
I'm afraid I don't watch much television and I don't go to movies much. This is true of most of my older friends, and I don't know why it is. I think it's partly because in the area of comedy, I've seen so much comedy over the years. The moment that I used to have in my 20s when I would discover Buster Keaton, you know, it was almost like an intellectual orgasm. You suddenly watch this extraordinarily funny man and a brilliant man and watch his stuff. And that doesn't happen so much. I think the last time I had that feeling was I saw a Texan, and I've gone blank. His last name was Hicks. You know this guy? Absolutely.
Bill Hicks, is it?
Yes, Bill Hicks.
Bill Hicks, yes.
And I thought he was everything that I've forgotten another name. You see, this is what happens. There was a very famous Jewish satirical comedian. I'm not talking about Mort Sahl. Lenny Bruce.
Oh, Lenny Bruce, of
I
course,
thought
yeah.
Bill Hicks was everything that Lenny Bruce was cracked up to be, and I never thought Lenny really? Was as good as
yeah,
he
is funny.
I thought Bill Hicks was fantastic. Yeah. And then 6-8 weeks later, he was dead of pancreatic cancer.
Right.
But that
yeah.
was the last time I saw someone, and I thought, my God, this is good.
Mm.
And it's because you've watched so much comedy and seen so many great practitioners, the chances that anyone's really going to come up with anything quite new is very, very small. And I think probably some of Steve Martin's films, the ones that I would immediately go to, I thought Roxanne was absolutely wonderful.
Yes.
And the one with Lily Tomlin and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah. And The Jerk. I still say The Jerk is one of the funniest movies ever.
One of the funniest ever. I thought he was terrific, but he's writing very good novellas now and play the banjo. He's so multi-talented. But no, I think that what happened, there used to be an awful lot of very good writers about who would serve a long apprenticeship and would take their writing career very seriously and read about it and study it. And they understood construction. Now I think there are very few people who really construct comedies well. I mean, I had a play going into the West End. And in March, February, closed down while it was still touring prior to the West End. And it was my adaptation of a comedy, a farce, a French farce, written in 1895. And it was much better structured than almost any other comedy I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of brings up one thing that I found interesting in your book. It's something that I often hear. You say that writers should write what they know, but I've always felt that there should be a corollary to that, which is if you don't know anything, don't write.
Yeah,
somewhere along the way, everyone who's a writer in LA got told, write what you know. And so I've read so many scripts about being a writer in LA. I feel like there should be a minimum amount of life experience to be a writer.
Yeah, that's
you?
What writers finish up, right? I just started reading Philip Roth or something, Stain. And that's about a writer, about writing. I think the trouble is, if you're a writer, you spend so much time alone writing that you don't have the experience that you had when you started to write. I think that's why so many people write a really great first novel, and then the novel's still good, but they don't have that extraordinary freshness of the first one.
There's a very British question that I feel like maybe you would be the right person to ask. What is the deal with the Queen's wardrobe? Why does she always dress like someone out of a Dr. Seuss book with these matching hats and outfits and lime greens, canary yellows, colors that only exist in a comic book? Do you know what that is?
I think that the great success of the royal family, which has been rather less in recent years with the various escapades of the younger members, but I think the great success of the British royal family was that they were fundamentally very boring and not very controversial. I mean, the only thing that gets the Queen really excited is horse racing, but she also loves dogs. Now, anybody who loves horses and dogs rather more than ideas is going to be well liked in Britain. Do you see what I mean? Because they don't look as though they're trying to show off how smart they are. So it was their very dullness, I think, that meant that they lasted longer than a lot of kings and queens did. But I agree with you. I mean, I have no idea why people are so interested in the royal family and why the newspapers and magazines are so full of their doing. It's because I think they're very nice people, but not very interesting. I mean, there are so many more interesting people.
So you think that she wears these outlandish get-ups because that's her way of trying to make herself interesting to people?
Well, I don't know. Or maybe it's a way of making sure that people don't think she's that interesting.
Okay.
Because you don't want too much attention, you see. The moment you get attention, people like you for the first time.
Right.
And they start looking for the weaknesses. But she's done a splendid job as a queen, even if she hasn't done quite such a good job as a mother.
How do you feel about Charles taking over? Is that something to look forward to, or would you rather see it skip over to William?
I've met him a few times. I've had dinner with him and sat with him, and I once even did a couple of scenes in a movie with him about the environment. And he seems to me to be interesting and a very nice chap, much more interesting than most of the royals. I mean, I think Andrew is interesting for all the wrong reasons.
Right.
The other one, who's going to be king after Charles? What's his name?
William.
Back to the Middleton go. Yeah, William. William. I would pay money not to have dinner with him. He's so dull and ineffectual. He looks like a character called the Duke of Kent, who we always used to laugh at. He always looked sort of strangely uncomfortable, whatever he was doing.
By the way, I heard that you turned down a CBE, Commander of the British Empire.
I turned down a peerage. I was offered Lord Cleese of Uphill or somewhere. It was explained that if I became a lord, I had to sit in the House of Lords, of course, but that I had to be there during the winter. And although I thought it would be interesting because you could get on committees and find out stuff that nobody else knows, because you get, you know, and I have insatiable curiosity about certain things like, security services. But I realized there's no way I could stay another winter in England, because there's no point in being in England. Like, it's like being in the trenches in the First World War. You kind of wonder whether you're going to die before spring comes.
Okay, so not worth it, right? That comes with actual responsibilities and so on. Heavy is the head that wears the crown, or the wig, I guess.
Well, I don't think they wear wigs, do they? Maybe
do they? Oh, do they? Did they stop that? Maybe I thought that one house still wears the wigs, but I might be wrong.
They might do. So I don't know. I think there's some very nice people in there. There's also several crooks who got caught, like Conrad Black. You remember that wonderful photograph of him taking files and hiding them in the boot of a car so that he could destroy them? Well, he's a lord. Gave up his Canadian citizenship, so he could people to law. I mean, that poem they owed in the Britain in a country churchyard says, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. Mm-hmm. You know, and I kind of processed that a lot when I was about 18, and I've never thought that all this rubbish about honors was really quite worth it. Mm-hmm. If you see what I mean. And there are several people like Alan Bennett and Michael Frayn who are my heroes, and they've never accepted any of those honors which must have been offered to them. And I just think it's plainer and less, people are always trying to pretend that they're special, aren't they?
You know? Right.
I think it's quite
understandable. Really. It's a weird phenomenon, because I feel that I've talked to several British actors and maybe people in other fields who were offered a CBE and turned it down. But I'll tell you, I've never met someone who turned down a GBE or a KBE. I'm almost wondering if everyone's holding out for a knighthood. Is that what's going on?
I have a feeling that the two guys that I've just mentioned were offered knighthoods. But don't know if they have peerage is much better than a knighthood. I mean, knights are, you're knee deep in knights. Lords, there aren't so many of them around, even if there are some of them crooks.
But nonetheless, I still think that it would be a wonderful full circle moment for you to go from playing Sir Lancelot in the Holy Grail to an actual knighthood.
Yes, I know. But don't forget, when they gave Michael the knighthood, it was primarily for something like geography. You see, because otherwise, I mean, the people in charge are always slightly uncomfortable around comedians and comics and humor.
Right.
Because they do tend to be a bit pompous. Not all of them. I don't think Charles is too pompous, but pomposity cannot exist in a humorous atmosphere, because it's kind of, there's an artificiality about it. True. Humor immediately destroys. And therefore, people don't reward funny people in the way that they do straight actors. And I mean, the most example of that is true of America, because Charlie Chaplin, well, I suppose he's the greatest comic actor, or one of the absolute, never got an Oscar, you see, because he did.
That's right. He got an honorary one, I think, years later.
Right, but, later. He got a, like,
not a legitimate Oscar
at the time,
in that sense.
When he produced those extraordinary ones in the 20s, and so never got it, And I actually thinking of writing a book about why people think that drama is so much more important than comedy. Because as Jonathan Miller once said to me about that, he said, well, Mozart liked comedy and Shakespeare liked comedy, so it's good enough for me.
Well, that's so true. And of course, you got your Oscar nomination for A Fish Called Wanda, which,
and
I want to say that's a rare thing for a comedy to get a nomination.
Got Best Supporting Actor for a comedy performance, which is also rare. But somehow people think drama is more important than comedy. And the answer is, there's a lot of bad drama and there's a lot of bad comedy. But when you get to the very best, great comedy is much rarer than good, great drama. If I asked you to come up with 20 great dramatic movies, it would take you 15 minutes. If I said 20 great comedies, I bet you'd be running short after about number 7 or 8.
I've always felt it's much easier to pull on those handful of strings to make someone cry than it is to make someone laugh.
Yeah. That's
that takes a whole other set of skills.
Exactly right.
Well, this has been such a delight, and I appreciate your being so generous with your time. Again, I want to remind folks of your new book. It's called Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide.
Can I point out that how long did it take you to read the book?
You know, I would say probably about an hour, maybe just over about an hour. And I'm a very slow reader. I'm a notoriously slow reader.
That's
because
I
always have to go back and process everything.
Can I add this? You know that somebody once, I think it was Mark Twain, said, I'm sorry, this is such a long letter. I didn't have time to write a shorter one. But I had time to write a shorter book, and I didn't put anything into the book that wasn't essential. I could have written 300 pages, but I wanted to make sure people could read it in an hour and get maybe 5 ideas from it that could enable them to become more creative. And it seems to work.
Yeah, and I like that because it keeps it broad. You don't get too much into the weeds with specialties like being a writer or an artist. So if someone comes in as an architect or a lawyer or a scientist or whatever, there are applications that they can use in whatever they're doing, really.
But you got to tell your wife one thing from me. I was in a therapy group for 3.5 years. It was a couples group. And a very large percentage of them were lawyers.
Yeah, really.
And what I noticed about the lawyers, who were all men, what I noticed was that they could speak very persuasively for or against anything.
Mm-hmm.
But they never emotionally quite knew what they believed in.
Okay, I'll have to tell her. She is very convincing. I can't win an argument with her, but she also is quite passionate about her opinions as well. So
yeah, well, that's all right. But I mean, the thing about lawyers we have to remember is if they're attacking you in court, the reason is that you didn't hire them. Well, maybe you should hire her to put your point of view. That would be a very difficult situation.
Wonderful. I hire her to advocate for me against her.
Yeah, against her.
That would be a wonderful Python sketch, I think.
So. It would be, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Well, this has been so much fun. Once again, I'm going to give that title to the folks. It's Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. John Cleese, thank you so much. This has been a
great
blast.
Great pleasure. Great pleasure.
Thanks again to John Cleese for coming on the podcast. Once more, you can order his book, Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide, on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And follow him on Twitter at John Cleese. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.